and in that missive I explained to her that I had chosen her to receive my last note from our common country, because I considered that she, Clover, how did I put it? Because I consider you the incarnation of your native land, is the precise wording, I think. Clover wrote back at once, saying that she considered my gesture a most equivocal compliment, and she continued, am I then vulgar, dreary, and impossible to live with? James looked up at Holmes, but the detective showed no response. Finally, Holmes said, so the lady did have wit and a sharp tongue. Do you have another example? James quenched a sigh. What good do such stories do now, sir? Clover Adams was a victim of a murder, said Holmes, or at least of someone's cruel hoax that she was murdered. In either case, learning who the lady's enemies were, even enemies created by the sharpness of her own acerbic wit, is the obvious way to approach this case. Unless, of course, as was the case in this instance, it was not murder at all, but rather a suicide, said James. In which case, your list of suspects in the so-called case is quickly narrowed to one name. Elementary, my dear Mr. Holmes. Not always, Holmes said cryptically. I have investigated obvious suicides that were the result of other people's murderous schemes. But please continue. James did sigh now. My other friends in the Five of Hearts had, for years, expressed their admiration, if not outright adoration, of my fiction, he said. Henry Adams, John Hay, Clarence King, even Clara Hay were genuinely enthusiastic about my stories and novels. Clover Adams was always more reserved. At one point, an interlocutor who, shall we say, knew the lady well, said that in an argument with her husband and John Hay on the literary merits, or lack of same, of a certain Henry James, Clover was quoted as saying, the problem with Harry's fiction isn't that he doesn't chaw what he bites off, but rather that he chaws more than he bites off.
Droll, said Holmes. And I presume the American colloquial dialect was meant to be part of the humor.
James said nothing.
I am surprised that someone close to both of you chose to report that particular bon mot to you, said Holmes.
James remained silent. It had been told to him in one of the finest of London's clubs by no less than Charles F. Adams, Henry Adams's brother, a man whom Henry James had always found to be vulgar in the extreme. Charles Adams had a cruel sense of humor, so unlike his brother's generosity, and enjoyed, James knew, seeing the edge of that humor embarrass or hurt others. Yet James had no doubt that Clover had said precisely those words. It was her dismissive style, and yes, her Boston Brahmin's use of rude American dialect. It had hurt James's feelings extremely upon the hearing, but he had kept Clover as his friend, and that Barb and others Charles Adams and others had relayed to him had done nothing significant to lessen his sorrow when James had learned of her death more than 7 years earlier. If Henry James wished to be truly indiscreet about Adams's brother Charles, he could have reported the cruel statement by Charles that John Hay had relayed to him as far back as the announcement of Henry Adams's and Clover Hooper's marriage.
Heavens, no! The Hoopers are all as crazy as coots. Clover'll kill herself just like her aunt.
Indeed, Clover's Aunt Carrie had killed herself when she was several months pregnant. And upon return to Boston after many months of the newlyweds' honeymoon in Egypt and Europe, it was William Dean Howells who had written to James about yet another truly vulgar comment in a letter from Charles Adams to Howells.
To see Henry these days, I have, quite literally, to tear him from the arms of his new bride. For Henry's always in Clover now. Joke! Ha ha!
The ha ha alone would have made James distrust Charles Adams for life.
Tell me more about Henry Adams, said Holmes.
James found himself shrugging. a gesture he had long ago given up in Europe. It was a sign of how upset even retelling the Clover anecdote had made him. What more do you need to know?
Far more than we can cover before this railway voyage ends in Washington, said Holmes. But for now we shall settle for what else Henry Adams was known for at the time of Clover's death, other than being descended from two American presidents and being a member of his wife's salon of the Five of Hearts.
If I gave the impression that the Five of Hearts was solely, or even primarily, Clover's salon, I was mistaken to do so, James said rather waspishly. Everyone in it, except perhaps Clara Hay, was a powerful personality. For four of them, save for Clara, who tends toward the literal in a pleasant way, their wit and even their sense of humor matched perfectly. They punned without mercy. I once observed in person that when one of the Adams' terriers came home with a scratched eye, John Hay immediately announced that it was obviously a cataract. Clarence King's instant addition was a tomcataract. Holmes waited. Henry Adams was a respected lecturer in medieval history at Harvard University, said James. He turned from academic circles to become one of America's most respected historians. He and Clover were consummate collectors. Adams continues to be so. And, as you may see if Adams is home and invites us to visit, their home reflects an astounding level of both high and advanced taste in everything, from Persian carpets to Ming vases to exquisite works of art, including constables and turners, chosen before most art collectors could recognize those estimable gentlemen's names. Their home, designed by the late H.H. Richardson, as was the Hayes, is a work of art. Holmes nodded as if he were taking mental notes on these most elementary of facts about a shy but world-famous man.
And Mr. John Hay?
A very old and rather close friend of mine, said James. I met Hay through William Howells, a famous editor and also an old friend, years ago, and have enjoyed seeing him and his wife Clara many times in England, on the continent, and in the United States. He is an extraordinary man.
So far, all of these Five of Hearts sound extraordinary, said Holmes, at least by American standards.
Before James could protest, Holmes went on.
I've read of Hay being referred to as Colonel Hay. Has he a military history?
James chuckled. When Hay was only 22 years old, he became an assistant to John Nicolay, who was personal secretary to President Abraham Lincoln. Holmes waited impassively. James waited for some flicker, some sign of the detective being impressed, or even interested, but none came. In truth, James continued, Hay served as co-secretary to Lincoln during the darkest years of the Civil War, but you see, there was no appropriation for a second secretary, nor even for an assistant to Mr. Nicolay as secretary. So his friend Nicolay arranged it that he, young John Hay, would receive a salary as an employee of the Department of the Interior assigned to the White House. When that was challenged by some appropriations committee in 1864, the War Department commissioned Hay as a major, Assistant Adjutant General of Volunteers, I believe was his full title. A year later, he was promoted to lieutenant colonel, and shortly after that, received the rank of full colonel.
Without ever seeing a battlefield, said Holmes,
only the ones he toured with President Lincoln.
I assume Mr. Hay has shown certain accomplishments, besides accruing wealth and a wife since then, said Holmes.
James did not especially like the detective's tone. It seemed very common to the writer, but he decided not to make an issue of it at that moment. The waiters were standing by the walls at the opposite end of the dining carriage, hands solemnly folded across their crotches, waiting for Holmes and him to depart. Even by the time John Hay married Clara Stone in 1874, when Hay was 35, he'd held important diplomatic posts in three countries. James didn't add that Hay had groused and complained of manners, language, culture, and government in all three of those important European countries in which he'd served. Also, by 1874, added James, John had become well known as a poet, then as a distinguished journalist. He was famous for his coverage of the Chicago fire and of the assassination of President Garfield in 1881 and of the trial of the anarchist assassin, Charles Guiteau.
Interesting, said Holmes. I confess that I wasn't aware that President Garfield had been assassinated, much less by an anarchist.
James simply did not believe this statement. He chose to say nothing.
Is Mr. Hayes still a journalist?
Asked Holmes. The detective had lit his pipe and showed absolutely no concern about the impatient waiters.
He became editor of Mr. Greeley's famous paper, The Tribune, but then returned to government service, said Henry James. In 1880, poor President Garfield had asked John to move from the State Department to the White House to become the president's personal secretary, but Hay declined. He left public service before Garfield was shot. Amongst his other pastimes, or perhaps I should say amusements, was writing fiction anonymously. At one time, his friend Henry Adams wrote and anonymously published a novel called Democracy. Since then, there has been infinite speculation about the author's identity. Clover Adams and Clarence King were both suspects of the literati's fever detecting at one point, but it was John Hay, who most of the experts were sure was the actual author. One rather suspects that the Five of Hearts enjoyed leading the literary world on their round-robin chase.
Democracy, muttered Holmes around his pipe. Did not that book sell rather well in England some years back?
Amazingly well, said James.
In England, in America, in France, in Germany, in Timbuktu, for all I know.
He was dismayed to hear an undertone of bitterness in his remarks.
And Clara Hay, said Holmes.
He removed his watch from his waistcoat and glanced at it.
A lady's lady, said James. A delightful hostess, a helpmate to her husband, a generous soul, one of the most important loci in the Washington social whirl.
How would you describe her physically?
Asked Holmes. James raised an eyebrow at the impertinent question.
A pretty face, an impeccable dresser, lovely hair, exquisite complexion. Physically, a bit on the pleasantly solid side.
Stout?
Solid, repeated James. She looked thus when John Hay fell in love with her and married her almost 20 years ago, and time and children have added their solidity.
And eating, thought James with a slight pang of betrayal. He remembered a letter from Hay only a year ago in which his dear friend said that the couple and their son were visiting Chicago, where he, Hay, had been very active indeed, but where Clara, according to Hay, had stayed at the hotel and tucked enthusiastically into every victual the dining room offered. Privately, Henry James thought Clara Hay to be matronly, not terribly intelligent. Although she was well-read and wise enough to admire James's novels, sanctimonious in a backwoods American Baptist minister's daughter's sort of way, although this was not at all her background, although she did come from Ohio, and altogether an unworthy member of the extraordinary Five of Hearts. He would never tell Sherlock Holmes this.
Tell me about Clarence King, said Holmes, and we shall return to our carriage and let these good people tidy up their dining car for the dinner service.
There is no dinner service on the Colonial Express, said James, inwardly pleased to have caught the famous detective out on an error. We are scheduled to arrive in Washington before the dinner hour.
Ah, said Holmes,
blowing a column of smoke from the oversized pipe.
Then you can describe Clarence King at leisure. Oh, I should say that I remember reading about Mr. King's exposure of that Western diamond mine hoax in the late 1870s, somewhere in Colorado, was it not?
It was supposed to be, agreed James. Clarence King, all 5'6" of him, is a truly extraordinary man. Geologist, mountain climber, explorer, surveyor, government servant, aficionado of fine food and fine wine and fine art. Henry Adams and John Hay always believed, sincerely one thinks, that of all of the Five of Hearts, Clarence King was the one whose future was least limited, most probable for fame, glory, and high position.
Did Clover Adams believe that?
James hesitated for only the briefest of heartbeats. She thought Clarence something of a rogue, but she loved him more for that, if anything. It was Clarence King who sent the Adamses and the other Hearts both fine Five of Hearts stationery for all of their use, and a beautiful Five of Hearts tea set.
"Describe it, please," said Holmes, removing the pipe stem from his mouth.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Please describe the tea set."
Henry James looked out the window at the increasingly summer-like forests and fields flashing by, as if he could gain strength from the gaze. It was evening. The last rays of a late March sunset tinged the trees and telegraph poles. "The tea set is quite charming, actually," he said at last. "Five cups and saucers, of course, all heart-shaped and a bit undersized."
"All five of the Hearts were small people," said Holmes.
"Why, yes," said James, a bit nonplussed by the observation. Had he supplied that information? He only remembered mentioning Clarence King's height.
"What else can you tell me about the tea set?" asked Holmes.
"The man is mad," thought Henry James. He said, "The tea tray is beautifully enameled and inset with designs that look like small fruit on branches, but are actually each a cluster of five hearts. The sugar and cream bowls also follow the heart's theme. On the teapot, and just below the upper appendage of the tray, which, if I remember correctly, is set off by a large and quite fragile capital T, are painted clocks showing the hour of 5 o'clock, exactly."
"The hour the Five of Hearts met each day of the work week," said Holmes, "usually in front of the Adams's hearth in chairs designed specifically for their diminutive size. Adams and his wife Clover seated opposite one another in tiny and matching red leather chairs."
"Yes," said James, having no idea where Holmes had dredged up that last fact, although it was accurate enough. Holmes nodded as if satisfied.
"Let us return to our rather public first-class carriage," he said.
Problems with the track somewhere south of Baltimore set the Colonial Express far behind schedule. For hours, Holmes and James sat in the relatively uncomfortable so-called first-class section with nothing to look at out the windows. Night had fallen hours earlier. No dinner, and little relief from the tedium save for their reading and an occasional cup of coffee brought by an apologetic steward. Holmes asked no more questions. A rather pathetic show for a detective, James thought, and they sat in silence for the long, humid hours. At long last, the express got back underway, but they arrived in the nation's capital many hours late, long after civilized Washingtonians had dined and after many had turned in for the night. But the Hayes brougham was waiting for them at the station, along with Hayes' first footman, Severs, and their trunks and valises were soon loaded outside and covered with a tarpaulin. A light rain had begun to fall as James and Holmes climbed into the compartment of the gleaming black Kinross brougham that Hay had sent for them. Street lamps were surrounded by soft halos that reminded James of the night some 11 days earlier when he and Holmes had met on the bank of the Seine. With those thoughts came a dire sense of something very much like terror. What was he doing introducing this strange and almost certainly deranged man into the inner circle of some of his closest private friends? Holmes' pathetic disguise of Mr. Jan Sigerson, Norwegian explorer, would be found out, if not on Sunday evening when the Norwegian ambassador was dining at the Hayes, then even earlier than that. What would his old friends, John and Clara Hay, much less Henry Adams, who never spoke to anyone of his late wife or her suicide out of the long resonances of his terrible grief, think of him for deceiving them in this way, for introducing this madman to them. Henry James was actively sick to his stomach as the brougham rolled through the brick and cobblestone streets of this least businesslike of all major American cities. The few shops, restaurants, and public places they passed along the way were closed and dark. Even in the finer neighborhoods here near the executive mansion, only a few interior gas or electric lights still burned. The trees in this southern city were fully leafed out, and it felt to James as if they were being carried deeper and deeper into a dark tunnel of his own foolish construction.
"I believe the Americans have a saying, 'They roll the sidewalks up after dark,'" Holmes said at one point, and the sound of the tall shadow's voice gave James a start, but did not bring him fully back from his broodings. "It certainly seems true of Washington, D.C., added the detective.
James said nothing. Then they were next to Lafayette Square. A darkened executive mansion was visible through the trees, and turning at the intersection of 16th Street onto H Street. St. John's Church rose whitely on one side of the street, and the Hay residence loomed in wet red brick on the other. John Hay was standing in the strange Richardsonian arched tunnel of an entranceway to greet them.
"Harry! Harry! We're so delighted you came back!" boomed Hay,
a compact, thin, elegant man with receding hair parted neatly in the middle, dark brows, and a full but triune-shaped mustache chin beard that was going white before the rest of his hair. Hay's eyes were alight with intelligence, and his voice echoed in the tunnel of an entrance with a sincere welcome. And then they were in the house proper. Coats and hats were smoothly removed by servants while other footmen bustled past and then up a staircase beyond the huge foyer with their bags and trunks. And James had made the treacherous introduction of Sigerson without faltering, although his heart pounded at his own deception and his mouth was unnaturally dry.
"Ah, Mr. Sigerson," cried John Hay. "I read about your Tibetan adventures last year in both the English and American papers. It is such a pleasure having you as our guest."
James could see Holmes looking around at the house, the mansion. The foyer was huge and paneled with South American mahogany, so perfectly polished that one could almost see one's reflection in the dark wood. Above the mahogany wainscoting, the walls were a rich terracotta red that matched the red in so many of the Persian carpets and runners set about on the gleaming floors. High above them, St. John's Cathedral high, the spaces above the gleaming chandeliers were crisscrossed with massive mahogany rafters. Ahead of them, the grand stairway was wide enough to accommodate a marching band walking 10 abreast if the occasion ever arose.
"Clara sends her deepest regrets for not staying up to greet you," said Hay. "I'm afraid she had to take to her bed early tonight due to one of those rare, fierce headaches that have plagued her for so long. She looks forward to meeting both of you at breakfast. Unless you prefer to breakfast in your rooms, of course. I know that you enjoy taking breakfast in your room, Harry."
"Alas, a bachelor's old habits," said James, "especially on the first morning after a somewhat arduous week and a half of constant travel."
"Clara and I shall see you later in the morning, then," laughed Hay. "Mr. Sigerson, would you also like to receive your breakfast in your room?" "I sincerely look forward to coming down and meeting Mrs. Hay at breakfast," said Holmes in what James now heard as an exaggerated, an obviously false Scandinavian accent.
"Wonderful," cried Hay. "Clara and I will press you on all the current gossip surrounding Harry."
He smiled toward James to show he was jesting.
"But speaking of dining, gentlemen, I know how late the train was in arriving, and also know that the accursed Colonial Express offers no dinners during its approach to Washington. You must be starved."
"We lunched rather late," began Henry James, blushing slightly not at the thought of putting his host out, but at the sheer awfulness of what he was doing.
"Nonsense, nonsense," said Hay. "You must be famished. I've had Cook and Benson set out a light repast for you."
He put a well-manicured hand on each of their shoulders and led them through the cavernous,
but strangely warm space and into the dining room. James saw at once that the dining room was larger, more elegant, and certainly furnished with a finer taste than the one he had seen in photographs of the dining room in Mr. Cleveland's White House. In every room they had been in or passed by, James had noticed the elaborately and beautifully sculpted stone fireplaces. The walls boasted art masterpieces interspersed with ancient tapestries and the occasional framed light sketch, the signs of high taste combined with a gifted collector's eclecticism. The light repast consisted of a groaning sideboard loaded with a freshly baked turkey, half a Virginia ham, salads, steaming vegetables, and a second buffet gleaming with wines, clarets, whiskies, waters, and various liqueurs. The long table had been set and lighted by candelabra for three at the far end.
"We are all bachelors tonight," laughed Hay. "We shall have to feed and fend for ourselves."
They did this, of course, by pointing and having Hay's Benson and two underbutlers fill their plates with their choices. When they were seated in the circle of candlelight, and after Hay had toasted their safe arrival in America, they set to. James was astonished to find that despite his nausea during the drive from the huge railway station, he was indeed famished.
"Harry," said Hay, addressing James, "I'm sorry to tell you that Adams is not yet returned from some southern lark to Cuba with Phillips. He was scheduled to return home last week, but somewhere down there he ran into Alexander Agassiz, and since then he's thrown schedules to the wind, quite literally, and has been geologizing on coral reefs with Agassiz. Evidently, they drifted north to further relax with the Camerons at the Coffin Point retreat on St. Helena. I must say that Adams is not exactly rushing home to spend time with me or his other friends here."
"Shall I miss them, then?"
asked James, shocked to hear some audible sound of relief in his own voice.
"Oh, no, I think not," cried Hay with a laugh. "I believe that Adams will show up in the first week of April, just days away now. You can enjoy the comparative sanity with us until he does arrive."
Hay turned to Sherlock Holmes.
"Is your repast edible after the ardors of your crossing and non-express colonial express traveling, Mr. Sigerson?"
"Delicious," said Holmes,
and James noticed that the detective actually had taken a few forkfuls of ham.
"Quite perfect, Mr. Hay."
"Good, good,"
boomed John Hay.
"And we shall do everything in our modest powers to make all the rest of your stay with us here in Washington equally as pleasant."
Hay turned back to James.
"Oh, Harry, another bonus. I've just learned today that Clarence King will be arriving in Washington tomorrow, on the way to or from some Mexican gold mine, no doubt, but he's agreed to join us for dinner on Sunday night. That is the night when King Oscar II's diplomatic emissary is dining with us. Clarence will be so delighted to see you after all these years."
James looked at Holmes and allowed himself a small but secretly wicked smile.
"You are in great luck, Sigerson," he said. "Not only will the ambassador from the King of Sweden and Norway be here on Sunday, but so shall one of the world's most famous and best informed explorers. I am sure that each of them will have many questions to put to you."
Holmes looked up from sipping his wine, smiled thinly, and nodded without comment. Chapter 9. Hay had said that breakfast would be served in the smaller dining room, the one with so many windows looking out into their garden area, at 7:30, so Holmes allowed himself to sleep until 7 a.m. He slept well but awoke with joint pains and an incipient sense of panic. Going into the resplendent bathroom that was amazingly part of his guest suite, Holmes unfolded a soft leather bag and removed the dark vial and syringe from their leather pockets. After holding the syringe's needle for a moment in alcohol that had come from a small stone bottle in an adjacent pocket, Holmes filled the syringe to the proper level, tapped it to remove any air bubbles, removed a short length of flexible chemist's tubing that was folded into the leather travel sponge bag, tied it tightly around his upper left arm, increasing the tension by gripping the tubing firmly by his teeth and tugging sharply, and then he injected the morphine into the vein at the crook of his inner arm. There were dark marks and scabs showing many, many earlier injections there. Holmes sat on the edge of the bathtub until the morphine began to work on his pain and panic. For the first time, he noticed that the bathtub rim and walls surrounding the tub were of a beautiful blue and white Delft pattern. He took his time bathing, marveling at the truly hot water that flowed instantly from the tap after only a slight turn of the silver spigot by Holmes's amazingly prehensile toes, and then shaved with his straight razor, while looking down from the mirror, frequently to throw suspicious glances at what looked to be a secondary and much smaller Delft bathtub permanently set into the floor near the corner of the wash basin. Holmes's incredible deductive powers told him that this must be some bizarre American instrument for bathing one's feet. At the very least, it was far too low to serve as a bidet, a French invention and toilette-related custom that Holmes, for all of his interest in staying clean, had always found disgusting. Bathed and shaved, Holmes touched up his Sigerson hair with a darkening agent, made the darkened hair wilder and more vertical with some patented hair cream and a tax from two hairbrushes, ran a mustache comb under Sigerson's nose, and dressed in a bit too woolly, thick green tweed suit for his day in the city. Then Holmes found his way down the huge stairway, where a servant immediately led him to the breakfast room. Wait a minute. The reader needs to pardon this interruption as the narrator makes a comment here. Perhaps it slipped your notice, although I doubt it, since it is dangerous for a narrator ever to underestimate the intelligence and observation powers of readers. But at this point, we have shifted point of view in the narrative. Up until now, I have kept our perceptions focused on what writers and professors call either a limited third-person point of view, the third person in this instance being Mr. Henry James, or at most, I have indulged in a very limited, limited omniscient point of view. In truth, there has been a distinct lack of omniscience throughout this manuscript. As the narrator in question, I may further alienate you from your suspension of disbelief vis-a-vis the current narration by telling you that I dislike shifting points of view in a tale. I find a narrator's presumed ability to hop from mind to mind both presumptuous and unrealistic. Worse than that, it is so often simply inelegant. As literature has descended into mere entertainment, via a deliberate vandalism and diminishment of our once proud language, authors also have begun leaping around between and into their characters' minds for no other reason than that they can. Regarding my shift to Sherlock Holmes's point of view, I could give a dozen convincing explanations as to why I make this shift at this time, i.e., Henry James later learned this information, and I, as narrator, am somehow receiving the intelligence from him retroactively in time. Neither will Dr. John Watson, M.D., ever hear the details of this 1893 American adventure, so I would be lying to claim the overused doctor as my source of information. Or perhaps this narrator could say that he has, through the usual arcane means involving opened bank vaults or misplaced trunks found in attics, come across a long-lost manuscript, discovered perhaps alongside Holmes's equally lost volumes titled The Whole Art of Detection, which conveniently included encrypted notes from these days in question, notes which somehow allow us to perceive things from the detective's point of view for this part of the tale. Surely more apparently miraculous things have happened in real life than this discovery of long-lost notes by the beekeeping retired gentleman who lived out the last years of his life in a small farm upon the Sussex Downs, 5 miles from Eastbourne. Alas, no. No encrypted notes from the beekeeper. No discovery of Holmes's promised but never found The Whole Art of Detection. To be specific, none of my information comes directly from James or Holmes, nor even from Dr. Watson or his literary agent, Arthur Conan Doyle.
At some point, I may or may not discuss the source of my information about this period and these men, but for now, the simple truth and short version are that I know more about most of Holmes's and James's 3-month stay in America in 1893 from Sherlock Holmes's point of view than James's. I don't know all of his thoughts. I do not have that power over or insight into either character, either man. But I do have more information on Holmes's actions during these weeks than I know of anyone else's in this narrative. And from that, any competent narrator should be able to guess or intuit or deduce or simply imagine many of his thoughts. But if the reader is not already overly estranged by this temporary shift in our focus, your narrator will do his best to keep the number of points of view to 2, while working diligently to keep those 2 viewpoints from hopping back and forth like the proverbial grasshopper in the very real skillet. The buffet in the sunny breakfast room was smaller than last night's long mahogany sideboard in the dining room, but its groaning nature was comparable. Artfully arranged on delicate china and in silver chafing dishes were the makings for full English breakfasts, light French breakfasts, astounding American breakfasts, and, of course, presumably because Jan Sigerson was supposed to be Norwegian, smoked salmon and slivers of whitefish, a salmon omelet, pickled herring, and English cucumbers, supposedly a London favorite of visiting Norwegians, mixed in with red and green peppers. John Hay, or to be more precise, John Hay's cook, had somehow provided siltetøy, a Norwegian sweet jelly, to go with the morning breads. With the French, Swiss, and American cheeses were Jarlsberg, Gouda, Norwegia, Nokalost, Pultost, and Grønost, a very sweet Norwegian cheese made from goat's milk. Holmes had tried Grønost once, and that, he decided at once, had been more than enough experience with the cloying goo. Sherlock Holmes filled his plate with bits of English, American, and Norwegian breakfasts. Although a French croissant and Turkish strong coffee were his usual breakfast when he was at 221B Baker Street, and enjoyed his morning conversation with John and Clara Hay. The 44-year-old Mrs. Hay, Holmes saw at once, had long since passed Henry James's somewhat unkind description of solid, had, probably in her mid to late 30s, passed through and beyond the category of matronly, and was now set firmly in a thick-set, multiple-chinned sort of upper-class glory that would probably stay with her until her last years. It did not seem to diminish John Hay's delight in her. Holmes remembered James saying that she was solid when Hay fell in love with her and seemed to revel in it. And in truth, Holmes still saw Clara Hay's beauty in the perfection of her clothing, the gleam of a perfect but modest jewel on one soft finger of her pudgy hand, the coruscations of her perfectly set hair, her near flawless complexion, and a lustrous quality to her wide, bright eyes that no amount of tucking into her vittles had or probably ever would erase. Also, Clara Hay was a pleasant, caring person and a wonderful hostess. Holmes, especially in his strange, wild-haired, fiercely mustached Sigerson persona, could tell that almost at once. Her voice was a pleasant contralto, and when Clara Hay was in a position where listening was called for, such as after asking Mr. Sigerson a question, she actually listened. Holmes knew how rare this gift was of being patient enough actually to listen, and immediately saw why Mrs. John Hay, Clara, to so many hundreds of her close friends, in that bold American way where people in society actually used each other's Christian names without that English fear that they would be mistaken for a servant, would be the indispensable hostess for a capital city such as Washington. When Holmes complimented Clara Hay on the beautiful blue and green gown she was wearing, and it was beautiful in a dignified and understated way, his hostess did not blush or act like a falsely modest maiden, but said, "Yes, it is nice, isn't it, Mr. Sigerson? Even if designed only for everyday wear. I appreciate your appreciation of it. A sign of your good taste, I believe. The design is by the Parisian couturier Charles Worth, who who was referred to me by our late friend, Mrs. Clover Adams. Clara Hay glanced at her husband, as if to ask if she could tell more. But if there were some signal sent from the colonel to his lady, Holmes missed it.
Clover used to say, continued Clara Hay, that a Worth gown not only filled her soul with happiness, but what was her exact phrase, John?
Not only filled her soul with happiness, but sealed it hermetically, said Hay.
Ah, yes,
said Holmes's hostess, smiling as he did. Monsieur Worth won Clover Adams's undying loyalty one day in Paris in 1881, when the couturier continued to stay with Clover and make last-minute alterations to her gown when both Mrs. Vanderbilt and Mrs. Astor were waiting in the outer room. That was enough recommendation for me, you see, and I have never regretted turning to Monsieur Worth first when we are shopping in Paris.
It is a truly stunning dress, said Holmes. Knowing as little as I do about such things, as I am a bachelor, I would still venture to say that Monsieur Worth's particular genius has more than repaid your allegiance.
He set down his empty coffee cup and shook his head slightly when the under-butler moved to refill it.
So what would you like to do today, Mr. Sigerson? Asked John Hay.
The more Holmes saw of the diplomat's long, white fingers, the more he was sure that Hay could have been a fine violinist if his musical tastes had turned that way, as Holmes's had at a young age.
We can wait for Harry and take a carriage excursion through the city, continued Hay. Show you the historical sights and monuments, drive through Rock Creek Park, perhaps peek in on Congress in session, and have some bean soup there for lunch.
Hay laughed easily.
Harry hates sightseeing of any organized sort, but we shall simply outvote him. That's what democracies are for, after all. The tyranny of the less cultured majority, such as myself. Thank you, said Holmes. But if you and Mrs. Hay do not mind, I would like to spend this first day in Washington, as I tend to spend all first days in new cities or locales, exploring on foot.
Very good, Hay said with real enthusiasm. Would you like us to give you some directions for the major sights?
Holmes smiled under his Sigerson mustache.
Getting lost is my preferred first step in each of my explorations.
Hay laughed at this.
If you leave before Harry comes down, we shall tell him that you will be back by...
When?
Said Clara Hay.
Shall we plan on you for luncheon, tea, or dinner?
Tea, I think, said Holmes. Do you have it at 5 p.m.? That is the hour, said John Hay,
dabbing at his lips beneath the billowing white mustache with a pure white linen napkin.
Although there may be other options than tea for us men if you've had an adventurous day exploring.
15 minutes later, James having still not made an appearance, Holmes left the house in his green tweed suit, a walking stick with a silver head in the shape of a barking dog, and a full briefcase clutched in his left hand. He was striding briskly under low gray clouds. The day was rather muggy, much warmer than either Paris or New York had been, and Holmes's, Sigerson's wool suit was too warm for such a spring day. But this did not stop him from walking at a very brisk pace with the effortless, long-legged strides of the indefatigable explorer he was supposed to be. The briefcase contained a strange change of clothes. In the upper inside pocket of his tweed jacket, he carried photographs of three men, one much younger than the other two. In his right trouser pocket, Holmes carried a French-made, spring-opening knife with a 6-inch blade that had a cutting edge so sharp that one could remove all the hairs on one's arm with it without feeling the slightest touch of contact. Holmes had two objectives for his day of exploring in Washington. The first was a mere local errand that might end up a tad expensive. The second was a longer voyage by foot into areas that would almost certainly be dangerous. He looked forward to the second task. Now, as he ambled along, seemingly oblivious to the threatening weather or even the city around him, he took in, as was his training and habit, almost everything around him. Holmes saw that no one was following him. Holmes noticed that while the homes were rather nice here near Lafayette Square and the Executive Mansion, what Americans had come to call the White House, they were mostly of the flat-fronted, old Federalist design, with their modest stoops opening directly onto the sidewalks. The exception to this traditional flavor had been the Hayes and Adams's towering twin piles of red brick in the Richardsonian design. Even as he'd walked away, Holmes had noticed that the bricks of Hayes' mansion facing 16th Street had been architect unique, longer, wider, and deeper than any standard building brick. He hadn't yet taken time to study the front of Henry Adams's house next door on H Street, but he hoped to see that home soon enough. The trees in bloom along the not very wide sidewalks were relatively young and short. Only in the parks had some of the chestnut and elm trees reached their mature height. Washington, D.C., although almost 100 years old, and despite its gleaming white Roman civic architecture and few great monuments, had the feel of a new and rather sleepy city. The boulevards were broad, but not very busy, even in late morning. By London or Paris standards, they were all but empty. On the busier cross streets, Holmes caught glimpses of small, hooded gigs, what the Americans called buggies, as well as fashionable cabriolets and chaises, commercial coaches and canvas-sided floats filled with milk churns or stacked marble, the occasional stylish four-in-hand dashing through traffic, some dog carts, usually with young people at the reins, quite a few gleaming black broughams of the quality Hay had sent to the rail station the night before, a plodding assortment of wagons, wagonettes, and vans hauling goods, a few men on horseback, and even a very few gleaming and belching brass and red leather horseless carriages being guided by men in dusters and goggles at the tillers. Even though he had to pass the Executive Mansion, Holmes's glance did not linger on the miniature white palace housing President Cleveland. The detective had last been to the White House in November of 1881, during the trial of President Garfield's assassin, the pathetic and more or less insane Charles Guiteau. Holmes had been pressed into the service by his older brother Mycroft at Whitehall and by Mycroft's superior in the intelligence services at the time, Sir George Mansfield Smith Cumming. In 1881, as now in 1893, the formal British Secret Service had not yet formally come into being. It will be founded in 1909. Much less branched into its domestic intelligence service, MI5, and its foreign intelligence service, MI6. But Prime Minister Disraeli had established a Joint Information and Research Unit that was actually an oversight and political liaison committee between the Prime Minister's office, Whitehall, and the hodgepodge of intelligence services run by the Army Intelligence Service, Royal Navy Intelligence, and half a dozen other military agencies. Mycroft Holmes, only 34 years old at the time but already indispensable at Whitehall due to his astounding mathematical ability and reasoning skills, was second in command of the Joint Committee, reporting only to the acting director at the time of its founding in 1881, Captain Sir George Mansfield Smith Cumming of the Admiralty's Intelligence Service. Mycroft was now co-director of the nascent British Secret Service, along with William Melville. Sherlock's brother had been given a basement office at 12 Downing Street for his intelligence duties, but Holmes knew that his massive brother had never visited the fully fitted-out Downing Street office. All Joint Committee and Military Directorate of Intelligence operations were soon directed out of Mycroft's office at Whitehall, with his nominal superiors coming there for briefings. This was because Mycroft divided his time between Whitehall and his own creation, the Diogenes Club, a private club half a block away from Whitehall and reachable by both formal tunnels and covered walkways. The older Holmes brother had divided his world between these two interior spaces. There was no third. He slept and ate and amused himself at the Diogenes Club. His younger brother had long known that Mycroft was terrified by open spaces. In years yet to come, Mycroft Holmes would be described as agoraphobic. The Diogenes Club itself, begun, as mentioned earlier, by Mycroft and half a dozen other very strange London men of means and power who shared a fear of open spaces and strangers, was by far the strangest of all the scores of men's clubs in the city. There were the usual newspapers and meals available, the usual staff of capable servants and silent waiters, a rather good dining room and an excellent and extensive library, comfortable sleeping rooms, and even more comfortable deep leather reading chairs in the upstairs lounge. But the primary rule and primary source of comfort for the Diogenes Club members was that members, and the very few and very rare authorized visitors, could not begin a conversation or speak to anyone, even other charter members, in any place except the sealed-off stranger's room. Mycroft and the other founding members of the Diogenes Club were not only afraid of strangers and of talking to strangers, they were afraid of clubs. Sherlock Holmes knew that his brother had many other debilitating phobias. Such was the nature of the de facto director of all of Her Majesty's de facto secret service in late March of 1893. When Sherlock was hastily dispatched to America in 1881 to interview and investigate President Garfield's assassin, Guiteau, an assignment especially inconvenient to Holmes, not the least of which reason being that he'd only recently settled into his new digs at 221B with Watson and was finally receiving his first trickle of private, paying clients, he assumed that the assignment was to be a waste of time due to what the consulting detective then believed was his brother Mycroft's phobia related to anarchists and what Sherlock Holmes saw as his brother's baseless fantasy about an international conspiracy of anarchists. Consulting Detective Holmes thought it was about as likely that there would be an annual anarchists' convention as any real conspiratorial connections between the random madmen. But while Holmes helped prove that Guiteau had been a lone actor, the continued international anarchist threats, bombings, assassinations, and sometimes elaborate plots turned out to be very real indeed. In 1886, Holmes was back in America, investigating the site of the so-called Chicago Haymarket Square massacre. It was Holmes who discovered who had actually killed the seven policemen. Papers and legend were suggesting then that the police had shot each other, and textbooks today repeat the calumny, and the results of his investigation remain secret to this day. A year later, in 1887 London, it was Sherlock Holmes and two men from a specially formed squad from Scotland Yard who prevented, only in the very nick of time, the assassination of Queen Victoria by the famed big game hunter and marksman for hire, Colonel Sebastian Moran, and an accomplice. The two had positioned themselves to fire Jebel rifles placed in an advantageous firing position within the closed Royal Aquarium opposite Westminster Abbey, just as Her Majesty entered her royal coach on her own Jubilee Day. The accomplice had been captured. The master marksman and ultimate mercenary huntsman Moran had somehow escaped through the maze of tunnels, labyrinths, steam pipes, and workers' service corridors beneath the Royal Aquarium. Holmes's first stop as Mr. Jan Sigerson was at the Clarkson Scientific Apparatus and Photographic Materials Shop, only some 10 blocks from the Hayes front door. As he entered the dimly lit interior, Holmes could not but speculate that this was almost certainly the very shop in which Clover Adams not only had bought her own photographic supplies before her death in 1885, but whoever had supplied her with the poisonous potassium cyanide fixing solution as a gift might well have also purchased it here.
"May I help you?"
asked a pleasant-looking man with sharp-boned but ruddy cheeks and the tiniest diameter spectacles Holmes had ever seen.
"I am looking for a magic lantern projector," said Holmes in his slight Norwegian accent.
"Very good, sir. For in-home purposes or larger commercial presentations, say in a music or science hall or general auditorium space?
To be put to relatively modest in-home use for now," said Holmes,
looking around admiringly at the rows of carefully lighted cameras, enlargers, glass plate slide projectors, developing devices, and rack after rack of chemicals. The place had the quiet aura of a wizard's shop.
Perhaps later, added Holmes. I will require a more elaborate projection apparatus.
To purchase today or to rent, sir?
To rent, said Holmes.
The irony was that he had no fewer than 3 specialized photographic plate slide projectors back at 221B Baker Street. He had used them for years for a wide variety of reasons, not the least of which was to project and compare fingerprints or microscopically enlarged shard ends of tobacco or cloth. But obviously he hadn't taken the bulky and delicate projectors, or any of his hundreds of carefully labeled glass photographic plates, with him when he'd arranged to die, along with the mythical Napoleon of crime, at Reichenbach Falls 2 years earlier. The clerk, who announced that his name was Charles MacCready, youngest brother of the late English actor William Charles MacCready, and that it was his shop and a pleasure to wait on the Norwegian gentleman, led Holmes into a curtained alcove near the rear of the store, where a cluster of black metal and gleaming mahogany and brass projectors sat on carefully lighted shelves. Mr. MacCready touched a black metal device.
This is the newest thing. The lamp is electric, so no illuminant fuel is required. A 7-foot electrical cord. No smell of paraffin or fear of tipping over or overheating. The mirror over the electrical bulb focuses the light, you see.
Holmes had noted that the hay house was electrified, but he thought it would be undignified to ask that cords be hung from chandelier sockets.
I won't require electric.
MacCready nodded and moved to a more compact black metal and brass device.
Here is a Woodbury and Marcy Psiopticon. It uses a double flat wick illuminant, fueled by kerosene, and you can control the height of the wicks for maximum light intensity on the images.
I think not, said Holmes, stroking his chin.
What is that smaller one?
A very bright and sturdy little projector manufactured by Ernst Planck at Fabrik Optischer und Mechanischer Waren in Nuremberg, said Mr. MacCready. But it takes small glass plates.
What is the size of the slides you wish to show, sir?
3.5 by 5 inches, said Holmes, reduced by half from original plate size.
MacCready nodded.
Then I'm afraid the little Ernst Planck model will not suit your needs. It's wonderful for small science class presentations or home magic lantern shows, but your presentation sounds more serious, more panoramic.
Yes, said Holmes.
We have double and triple-lensed projectors for special effects, especially when shown in a larger hall, said the proprietor. You may know that it allows the projection operator to fade from one image to the next, to overlay 2 or 3 images, and thus to give the illusion of movement if the slide images are consecutive in motion. They really act as a sort of motion picture projector.
Holmes shook his head.
I require only a good, solid, safe magic lantern projector.
What is this one?
Holmes touched the larger model with its boxes of mahogany and brass lenses and a rather beautiful red leather bellows lens extender. The detective knew its worth because he owned one almost identical.
Ah, yes, a very fine unit, sir, said MacCready,
setting his blunt hands on the larger machine.
Made by Archer and Sons in Liverpool. It is illuminated using a limelight burner, so one must take special care. It burns very hot, but the images are spectacular, in small rooms or large halls. You see that each side has a square hinged door opening into the illumination chamber as well as a blue glass circular viewing door with a swivel glass cover. The japanned metal top cover attaches the tall chimney cowl here.
MacCready gently touched an oval aperture.
I have the cowl and chimney in the back, Mr.
Sigerson, said Holmes.
You see, Mr. Sigerson, how easily the illumination unit slides right out with one easy pull of this brass knob.
I shall take it, said Holmes.
How many nights' rental, sir?
Just 2 nights. I shall return it on Monday.
That works well, since the shop is closed on Sundays, sir. So we shall charge for only 1 night's rental.
We would be delighted to have the projectors returned before noon on the workday they are due, if that is convenient for you, Mr. Sigerson.
Perfectly convenient, said Holmes.
He didn't comment on the price when MacReady quoted it, but counted the dollars out from a rather absurdly thick wad of American bills he carried in his pocket. Holmes pulled the shopkeeper's small pad closer, clicked open his mechanical pencil, wrote, and said,
Can you have it delivered to this address?
MacReady glanced at Holmes's handwriting and said with a tone of even deeper respect,
Colonel Hay is home. Absolutely, sir. It shall be delivered before 5 p.m. today. Oh, and I'll need fuel for it, said Holmes.
Included in the price, sir. The carrying bottles are foolproof and fireproof and set into their own wooden carrying tray. And may I compliment you on your choice, sir? Archer and Sons is a superb optical manufacturer, and this unit works with such brilliance that the viewers almost think they are actually there within the frames of the photographic slide. This projector will serve you well, whether you're presenting your slides to a packed house of scientists at the Smithsonian Institution or in the Executive Mansion itself.
Holmes smiled.
Those venues may have to come somewhat later in my schedule, Mr. MacReady.